Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Whether it's a poem, an opera, a painting, or a sculpture, artistic work can have overt and hidden meaning. It can tell a story or make a statement. It can make us feel at peace, stir up anger, or inspire us to think more deeply. Today, we talk about the intersections between art, education, and activism. Joining us is David Keene, Executive Director of the Kituat Center for the Arts. Hi, David.
Good morning, Mindy. How are you?
Good. And Robin Joyce Miller, artist, author, poet, educator. She's the resident artist at the Zion Union Heritage Museum. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Mindy. Good morning. How are you?
Good. And Jim Miller is a poet, public speaker, and retired banker. Good morning to you, Jim.
Good morning and Happy New Year, Mindy.
Thank you. David, Robin, and Jim kicked off a series of conscious-raising events and conversations at the Kituat Center for the Arts. Tell us a little bit more about what this series is.
So the series is called Black Lives Matter with a theme attached to each program. This was the idea of Robin and Jim. And the way it came about was after the George Floyd murder, there was a lot of pressure for organizations and corporations to make public statements. And I was really struggling with how to separate the feeling of David Keene from a statement for Kituat Center for the Arts that was really reflective of the community. I struggled a lot with it. And what I ended up doing was writing basically personal feelings of mine where, you know, I felt like I shouldn't be the one on the platform speaking. I needed to be listening. There was so much to learn. And in that struggle, I picked up the phone and I called Robin, who I had met, you know, occasionally. I can't say we were friends. Happily, we are now. And just said, hey, would you guys come over to the center and sit down with the president of the board and me and just talk about race. Talk about Kituat Center for the Arts and how we might be able to improve. And that's where the whole thing started. And out of that came a monthly series.
So, Robin, I know you've been really, and Jim Bennett, very inspired on you know, the different topics to cover in these conversations. What were your initial thoughts when David called and said, we'd like to do this?
Well, when David and I talked, what was interesting was David said, we're not going to have a discussion. He just wanted to listen. And he and the board of directors, Kathy Lynch Nutting, they listened. And that was a beautiful thing. And I'm a big talker, so it lasted 3 hours. We had a great time. And that's when we started to establish a relationship. I knew that as a teacher, I had been doing slideshow presentations. So the slideshow presentations, I said to David, I'm doing something already. I already have some things done. And David said, do you think you could do something for the rest of the year? And I said, let me see. And so as we talked and met, different things started to evolve. And I started saying, oh, wait, we could talk about this. And here's another show. And then I got to work.
Yeah.
So I've been writing scripts.
Yeah. Jim, what were your thoughts?
Well, it was an interesting, put it this way, the wife and I have been married for 40 years, and there's always been that question about who am I that she's always brought up, and I think that she's getting the opportunity to try to answer that question through the productions that we're creating, and we're trying to just bring some positive thoughts and ideas and constructive actual evidence of what we as a nation of black people have done that has been erased somehow in the history books in time. Yeah. And it's a good opportunity to try to bring this to the forefront.
Yeah. David, topics like racism and white privilege can be uncomfortable. There are times to simply listen. As you were saying, it's time to listen and times to engage in conversation. How is this series incorporating these opportunities, especially when it's hard to get people together physically?
Yeah, that's, you know, there's so many challenges. Even so, though, before COVID, you know, we've talked for years about how to be a more accessible community and to offer more accessible programming in a place where we live, where, you know, that it's more challenging than, say, in New York. And, you know, Robin and Jim came here from New York. I came here from New York. And so we were also interested in talking about those differences specific to the Cape. It's a long-winded way to say we struggle in developing a diverse audience in general. So we're really, and I believe this is a one step at a time, long road issue that so many people, I think, when there's something uncomfortable or a challenge, want to flip a switch and make everything fine. And so what I'm happy about in this relationship is it's very long term. You know, we're just putting one step in front of the other. And the fact that we're able to put these programs on our Katuit On Demand free YouTube channel means that, you know, we don't know who's watching them, but we know a lot of people are watching them. So on one hand, we're reaching more people than we would be able to in person. And yeah. I would also say that the people that we had in person for the earlier programs really, really loved them and loved being there and having a meaningful conversation after the show.
Yeah. Robin, before we talk about your contribution to the series at Katuit, you've talked about feelings of shame for being a person of color when you were a child. Tell us a bit more about the incidents that prompted those feelings.
Well, I remember one of the things that brought it to light how I felt. I ran into a cousin who was when he was 18 and I was 5. He came up from the South and he was with my grandmother living there for a while. And he relayed a story when I was an adult of what happened when I was a child. And he said, "You know, Robin, we come from African people." And as a 5-year-old, I ran around screaming, "I'm not African. I'm not African." So it gave me pause, and I realized that watching television, in fact, my first show that I did, Restoring My African Soul, I talk about growing up during the Civil Rights Movement and watching television and seeing children being bombed the same day I'm in church. 4 girls are bombed in Birmingham. Ruby Bridges is a year older than me. And I watched the Civil Rights Movement happen. I was in New York, but I was watching, and I said, what is wrong with our people that people hate us so much? So there was a feeling of shame coming from the fact that black was not considered beautiful for a very long time. Malcolm X brought that up, but there were so many things. When I watched the beauty pageants, blonde hair, blue eyes, or green eyes, that's what's the focus, that's what beauty is. So there were too many things that just said, my people are not valued.
Jim, how were your experiences growing up? Were they similar or different to Robin's?
Well, very similar. I mean, I came up under the tutelage of a middle-class family status. My father was in the sanitation department. My mother was in education. The world to me at that time seemed to be against, people of our nation. And I grew up with that going to school. I grew up, my parents always said that, you know, you got to be twice as good as the competition that you're going to be up against out there to even make a small dent for yourself in reality. And it was so true. I went through Catholic school, which was predominantly white. And there was a few people of color in the school, but predominantly white. My Catholic college, I went through same situation, and always trying to prove myself just to even get the general hello or something was like you still had to stand on evidence of your ability scale or something. And so it's always been an issue. You know, I've always been presented with, how good are you? You know, prove it, you know, that kind of thing, as opposed to some of my, so-called brothers on the other side, not even questioned in some instances about what they're able to do. So would be a little bit of the window of my perspective.
Yeah. Was this something either of you talked about with friends or your family, or was it something that you just internalized?
Well, parents
said.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think that my internalized thoughts came from a lot of the reasoning and wisdom that were, put in my head by my parents to go out and be able to defend individually by yourself, because they can't be with you 24/7 to have the wherewithal to go out and defend yourself in the best possible, and if not in educational capacity, to show, you know, where you're standing on and where you're coming from.
Yeah. Robin?
I want to piggyback on that, because we, as families, we did discuss it. These are, like Jim said, you had, your parents said to you, you got to be better. You have to be better. So we sat around, and especially, well, as not so much, well, as children too. As children, we were told this, but as we got older, the discussions around the table, especially, I remember when I would go to Jim, we would go for Sunday dinners. And Sunday dinners at Jim's, you know, mother, with his mother and father, she would take the New York Times and talk about the latest article, and being black and what it meant, that was subjects that we talked about. So how you feel, what it means, you know, she was my mentor as a teacher, Robin, especially as a black teacher, blah, blah, blah. So this kind of discussions always, almost always included race.
Yeah. This past summer, we did a program about racism on the Cape and Islands, and for the show, Robin, you shared a poem titled Never Had the Privilege. We pulled your reading of the poem, but before we hear it, give us the background on when and why you wrote this.
Sure. I believe, while we're here on the Cape, our church is West Parish in Barnstable, with Pastor Reed and Pastor Christy Burns, and they were doing something. The president of UCC decided on having a curriculum for white churches, particularly on white privilege. So they were having discussions at the church on white privilege. There were three discussions, group meetings after church. Jim and I were not there for the first two because we were in New York. But when we came back for the third meeting, I knew that they were going to ask us, as the only blacks in the group, what was our feelings about white privilege. So I wrote the poem, Never Had the Privilege. I didn't want to tell white people. My perspective has always been not to tell you what you have and what you've done, but let me show you what we don't have. White privilege means that we don't have this kind of privilege. We don't have that kind of privilege. So I wrote that poem the night before I was going to, you know, so Saturday night, I wrote that before going to church. So that's the poem. And later I turned it into a slideshow with images and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So here's Robin Joyce Miller reading her poem, Never Had the Privilege.
Never had the privilege to sail to liberty. We traveled as ship cargo, no chance of being free. Never had the privilege to have just one fine man. My husband could just watch me scream, Master takes me 'cause he can. Once we had the privilege, after slavery, during Reconstruction, to rise 'cause we were free. But then the southern breeze bore strange and swinging fruits, poplar trees bleeding from the leaves down to their roots. Never had the privilege to rise up and be free, paralyzed by the thought of claiming liberty. Never had the privilege to struggle on the land, to claim it as my very own, only sharecropped for the man. Never had the privilege to become Mrs. Gladys Height. My name was always, come here, girl, I'm calling you. That's right. Never had the privilege to eat at the Five and Dime, but I could wash the dishes and scrub the floors just fine. Never had the privilege, when traveling on a bus, to find a decent restroom, 'cause I ain't white enough. Never had the privilege to see someone like me, when I was just a child, be respected on TV. Then we had the privilege as Obama president, and a person they call Oprah. This must be evident, that race is not an issue, not even a concern. What's with this Black Lives Matter stuff? It's wrong and it's divisive. America is not racist. These rebels are misguided. Is it a law or a privilege that a person is presumed innocent until proven guilty? Well, never had the privilege to prove innocence or guilt. My black skin was the evidence for which my blood was spilt. Never had the privilege never had the privilege. Never had the privilege.
That's Never Had the Privilege by Robin Joyce Miller. And we will talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the intersection between art, education, and activism and a Black Lives Matter series of conversations at Kituat Center for the Arts. And with us is David Keene, Executive Director of the Kituat Center for the Arts, Robin Joyce Miller, artist, author, poet, educator, and Jim Miller, who's a poet, public speaker, and retired banker. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. David, art from our region has been stereotyped as paintings of sailboats and, you know, songs about sand dunes and what have you. Give us a sense of the diversity of the art and the artists on the Cape and Islands and how it has changed, or has it?
You know, it's funny, when the first thing that popped to my mind is for 10 years, the curatorial committee that decide what goes into our visual art section of our campus, the tagline is "No sunsets or sailboats ever," you know, because you just see that everywhere. So we've I think it's been a little easier, frankly, to be a little more diverse on the visual art side. We try to, when we have open juried shows, we really encourage and try to get as diverse an artistic group to submit work into the show. I know Robin, you've submitted work and had work hung in many shows. We've had a few solo shows by African American artists, some local from the Cape, others from off Cape. We've had one particular staged reading of a play, Duke's Train, I struggle with how to say this without sounding patronizing, but it's like the standard where if we play our cards right down the line, we can present programming that is appealing to a much more diverse audience and they will come. But we have such a long way to go, and we need help getting there. And that's why I think this series is really terrific. I think, you know, also, Mindy, having the Black Box Theater, we've always been able to push the envelope a little bit in the theatrical sense. We try to diversify in our educational program as well. And collaboration is key. So not only the collaboration on the Black Lives Matter series, we've done a couple of collaborations with Zion Heritage Museum in the past. We just need to do more and stay on this road and explore every opportunity.
Right. Robin, I know you are really excited about this series, and not only in the ones you've already presented, but in just even chatting with you, you go, I'm going to do something on, you know, Black lives in film and TV. You have all these ideas.
I'm motivated. What made me laugh, you just said about the dunes. First of all, one of the next ones that I'm working on right now, because I finished Black Churches Matter this far by faith, but the one I'm working on next is Coming Black to Cape Cod, and I'm starting it off with the song Old Cape Cod. And so there, I've got there's the beautiful, the sand dunes and the, you know, what Old Cape Cod is. And exciting.
There's a lot to cover. Jim, you and Robin summered on Martha's Vineyard for years before buying a home on the Cape. So talking about coming to Cape Cod, talk about your decision to settle here instead of on the Vineyard, which does have greater diversity.
I had nothing to do with it. Also, I was kidnapped, brought from New York up here to the Cape, and I was forced to live here. No, actually. It's partially true, because I really was not thinking about home ownership, okay? I was just into survival and just trying to make my wife comfortable and stuff. And her dreams, I try to support her dreams, and her dreams got us here. And I'm still trying to put all this stuff together and absorb it. It's just a huge I don't know, if you want to say a little slice of heaven in our experiences here, and then hooking up with the other museum that we were working with, the first Zion Heritage Museum, and there was a family there that really reached out and greeted us and wanted us to join them, and then the culturally inclusive Kituat Center. I mean, it's just, that was a knockout punch to really be received by them, because this is a huge institution, and but they have proven themselves to be what they say they are, and they are culturally inclusive, and they are growing, and I hope they become even more of a force going into the future, because they are a great platform, and they're trying to represent peace and harmony and inclusiveness on the Cape, and that's a significant thing.
All right, Robin, why Cape Cod?
I mean, all honesty, to me, it didn't, you know, I talk about my faith, and that I had not planned on buying a house in Cape Cod. I literally said that
I think was
grown. And so we ended up renting a house, and when we rented the house, we did want to buy it. I wanted a getaway home. And the realtor that we returned the keys to when we stayed in East Falmouth, he said, we sell houses here. And I said, I'm not buying a house in Cape Cod. I mean, that's my first response. And then next thing I know, I said, well, wait a minute. I don't really go. We took a vacation up in New York, and we did, and I didn't like the areas, Catskill, Adirondack. We always go to Massachusetts. Let me call that man. I called him back, and the rest is history. And it just seemed to lead. And it was interesting because he said, your art will, he said, you'll be great as an artist here. I said, are you kidding? This is Cape Cod. Everything is sailboats and fish and whatever. So there's enough of that. We need what you have to bring. And I didn't quite believe him. I mean, I was like, yeah, sure, they're going to want my black art. And so that was my thought, but things have evolved in such a beautiful way. And here we are. To me, it was like we were guided here, because I never in my life planned it. There was a teacher in my school who said when she retired, she was going to go to Cape Cod. I just listened to her like, yeah, okay. And she does not live here now. I called her when we got the house, and she said, oh, no, I don't live in the, you know, other things happen, but I never, it was never a dream. Even or Martha's Vineyard, quite honestly, can't afford it. It's on the. It's not. It's we want to be able to come back and forth, but the ferry.
I think Robin, I think your line is kind of cutting in and out. Maybe Elsa can get you on a better line. And in the meantime, let me ask Jim about this. Jim, you and Robin have had good experiences as people of color on Cape Cod, but that's not everyone's experience, right? I mean, I'm sure you hear stories from other people of color who have not had such positive experiences. What are your feelings about that? And you know, how do you talk about that?
Well, from a ground view, it's, you know, from a you know, really rubber meets the road experience, I think it's there's a lot of elements involved in the exchange of communication between people, or you generate the style of mode address that you have, how you try to reach goals that, you know, two separate people have different goals and somehow try to meet in the middle. It's a hard thing to just pinpoint, but I know coming from my side, I try to bring the best of myself to people, everybody across the board, and hope that I'm received, and keep reading the word, because the word is saying that what I should be focused on is, you know, trying to ultimately show everybody that I run into that there's a God, and that God exists in me, and that is a fairness that everybody's entitled to receive, regardless of color, creed, and everything else.
Yeah. David, you talked about trying to be more diverse, and I think Jim sort of echoed that. You work with a wide variety of artists, from musicians to playwrights to visual artists. Over the past few years, are you seeing more work that addresses themes of social, racial, or environmental justice? And what are some of the works that stand out to you?
Oh, gosh. Yes, I think what stands out to me is sort of is really more in a lot of literature in discussing white privilege and diversity, In terms of artistic output, let me take our theater, for example. We're a community-based theater, and so there's a lot of theater being written now that, for a couple of reasons, will be years down the road before a place like Kituate Center for the Arts will be able to produce theater that is really relevant in its theme about diversity and inclusion and some of what we're talking about today, because there are intellectual property rights issues. Mm-hmm. Often plays go to Broadway, and it can be a decade or more before a community theater, which is, there are steps in between a professional to non-professional community-based theater. So part of what, in many cases, what we would like to do, we can't. And then in the, you know, I've had this dream of doing a musical like Hairspray for years. And I think at a certain point, we just have to put a stake in the ground and say, you know, we're a little more diverse, I think, than we all think we are, but mm-hmm. we're still separate in terms of when I go back, I keep going back to the audience. And if I could, I would like to just mention before I forget that one of the things that's so great, I think, about what we're trying to do with the Black Lives Matter series is Robin and Jim have both said it a couple of times, that they come from a positive stance, that there is a desire for peace and harmony. And when you get into the programs, they get very you know, uncomfortable and point out the ugly truths of racism in this country, but it's all wrapped around a desire to communicate and talk mm-hmm. and educate and inspire one another. And to me, I think that's the key, because we're in a world where there's so much that goes on where we don't look one another in the eye. It's easy to make a statement when you're typing on a keyboard, and this division that we are all living through right now, it just seems to be often in a point of no return. And when you have, in my experience through all of this, it gives me hope that there's a way to get people together from a different point of view to say, okay, I want to hear what you have to say, and vice versa. So it's a mm-hmm. two-way listening street.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, you know, Robin talked about working on some of the upcoming conversations. So certainly these are conversations that are going to keep going through in 2021. But I'm sure the people going, wait, what about the ones that were, I missed those? You can still see them.
Yes, all of them are. Yes, and they're free. So we have a YouTube channel called Kituate On Demand. If you Google Kituate On Demand YouTube, it will take you right there. And you can watch all of them. And the other thing to keep in mind is that each show we get together and we analyze. You know, the desire is to be better each time. Mm-hmm. So you know, we're our hardest critics, I would say. I'm sure Robin and Jim, you agree with that. And each next time, you know, we want to improve. So we're in a state of perpetual improvement. Jason Mellon, who has been our box office manager and is now moving more into the programming area. You know, he's been integral in putting together the video components and the music. So it's a group effort where we say, what didn't we hit? What resonated before? What can we do better? And I can't speak for Robin and Jim, but for me, my ultimate goal is having a post-vaccine world where we can have 200 people in the live show where we also have a streaming component, and then have mm-hmm. this conversation that is just ongoing in the future.
Yeah, I think one of the more popular ones was the Black Children's Matter. Robin, tell us a little bit about that presentation.
That's special to me because I'm a retired teacher. And I've spent my life working with children. And I also, I'm a mother, and I remember my own childhood. And so in that one, I go back to my own childhood and my feelings of not seeing blackness in the world as far as cards and and movies and TV shows and what I didn't see, even Jesus being white. So that one moved me, and it's also important. I remember Negro history, and then became African, Black History Month, and I wanted in that one to, and this is what I do for each show, I try to find something that many people don't know, Black people included. And especially when David asked me to do this, he said, white people want to listen. So I was like, well, I'm going to be the one to tell them, because I'm going to look for everything that they need to know that is important. So that's how I program my thinking. And the children one was special because I put a lot of African-American history in there.
Yeah. And so how are you engaging with audiences to discuss some of the themes? As we're talking, some of these are uncomfortable. And David said some people sitting there in the, you know, in the beginning when they had live audience, uncomfortable. And probably the same thing when you're live streaming it. How are you engaging some conversation at the end with something that can be such an uncomfortable topic to talk about?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, sure, Robin,
well,
go ahead.
I'll be honest. The people did not, the people who came, it's like you're preaching to the choir. The people who you want, they all came with open ears and listening. So it really wasn't that difficult because they were not coming to, in an accusatory way, they were coming just to hear. And so we always go with it with an open attitude of, this is a learning opportunity. One, we tell people that we're, ask them why they came, they learn from it, what was surprising to them. So it's really a wonderful engagement of conversation.
Yeah. David, white people are often afraid to engage in conversations about racism and white privilege because they're concerned they'll say the wrong thing. And we've talked about this, David, right? So how do we move past this? Because we're going to say the wrong thing sometimes, right? So David, I want to hear from you first. How do we move past that?
I think you just can't be afraid to say the wrong thing and accept that. It's part of the growing and learning process and trying to be sensitive. You know, I try to be aware of, I really think about white privilege a lot. And I try to come from that place that, you know, I am, I live a privileged life. I'm also male. I struggle to come up with the words for a question that I might want to discuss with Robin and Jim, for example. And then also there's the humor part of it. It's understanding levity and being able to, it's a very, very serious subject. It's incredibly important. But if there's levity that's inserted, it sometimes can break a wall down where you can have a different level of a discussion. So those are just some of the things that I think about, and again, I'm really grateful to Robin and Jim for helping me, and I know that Kathy Nutting, our board president, and Jason Mellon, the five of us really have worked together on this for so many months. They would say the same thing.
Yeah. Robin, what are your thoughts on how we get past this?
First of all, David's absolutely right about laughter is something that's helped my marriage, that's helped a relationship. When we come together, David, Jason, Kathy, Jim, and I, we do a lot of laughing. And I also feel that as an African-American, when I'm opening these subjects up to a mixed group, as a teacher also, I know there are no wrong questions. I want people to feel that they're in a safe environment, say whatever they're thinking, and then if I don't hear what someone's thinking, and even if somebody will say, well, that's wrong. No, this is how we break down the racism. This is what we do. We listen, and I listen carefully and thoughtfully and try to help the person to understand what they don't understand. And I know that some black people, have said things like, okay, I'm tired of teaching white people how to behave. But I'm not. This is what I think I'm meant to do. So I love it.
Yeah. Jim, you want to add anything?
Zombie sheep.
What the heck is that? Okay, see, this is where the comedy comes in.
Okay, hold up. Okay, I'll explain zombie sheep. Okay. When we were in Kootenai and we had, all the folks that came in during the time that we did have the opportunity to have a live audience, I believe that the audience came in with a very open mind to find out what was on the other side of this nonviolent approach of, broadcasting what it is to be black and bring out the ingredients of the importance, the contribution to the community, to society, spiritual community. There's so much that I think every nation of people have something to offer, and the question ultimately comes down to why can't we all be recognized for our gifts and our talents, the time. God's given us all time to do something with ourselves, and we've been not given the opportunity to really use our time the way we would like to, maybe, a little bit more.
What are the zombie sheets?
But now the zombie sheets are when the audience came in, I think that they were so filled with some of the information from the show that it was hard for them to really come back with a full reaction because they were still mulling over the contents of the show.
Oh, and then we came up with questions for them.
And I played around and said they need to give them zombie sheets so they'll know what they're going to be getting before they come in.
But oh, right, okay.
That's the term I was using.
Okay.
But it's comedy, it's not.
Focus. It's real. I would prefer to use the word focus sheet, okay? The teacher in me is going, what are you talking about zombies? Okay, it is a focus sheet, okay?
Okay.
This is where the comedy comes in. I look at him and go, what are you talking about?
Little levity is a good thing. We're talking about Robin and Jim's series of Black Lives Matters conversations at the Kootenai Center for the Arts. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the series of Black Lives Matter conversations with Robin and Jim Miller at the Kootenai Center for the Arts. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us, Robin Miller, Jim Miller, and David Keene, who's the executive director of the Kootenai Center for the Arts. Robin, the typical American history curriculum in schools only touches African-American history when it mentions slavery and civil rights. If you could create a new American history curriculum for schools, what aspects of African-American art, culture, and history would you include?
Well, as a teacher, one of the things, as an art teacher, I immediately brought in African-American artists into the curriculum. So it really, it's going to be every area, because American history is American history. So all the stories about African American people and what they've done, it should be just be integrated when we talk about famous scientists, when we talk about famous inventors, whatever we're talking about, it should be included. It's not a separate part of history. So it's so deep, it's just integrating it into the books, what we talk about. In African American history, and put it in the regular American history book.
Yeah, what you're saying, we teach subjects kind of individually, but in reality, science, art, history, language, it's all a big tapestry, right? So,
absolutely.
So if we explored it that way, go ahead, David.
Robin, was it Matisse in Harlem?
Yes. See, yeah, right. For the years that I taught, I taught 14 years, I taught art. I did not know that Matisse went to Harlem that was in my in the jazz series. I talked about how Matisse went to Harlem and how what he got, and in fact, his whole jazz collection was inspired by his going to Harlem and learning about jazz. And so it's fascinating to know how many whites were inspired to do the work that they did. And even as we talk about vaccines now, Onesimus was an African slave who came to Boston, and he was the one who introduced vaccines into America.
because they were doing that in Africa. So that's affecting us today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Robin, describe the term white savior and how that's been portrayed in film and TV. I know this is a topic you want to do in one of your upcoming conversations.
Yes, the white savior in, and there's also, the person really, Spike Lee talks about these things, and he talks about the magical Negro and the white savior trope. And so the white savior, and even in a story that has a black story, a black thief, there's always a white person who helped them get there. Who you must, in film, either the black person as the magical Negro, his purpose is to help white people. And even though he does, he's an extremely brilliant, has special gifts and talents, we know nothing about his life. He has no life. His only life is to serve the white protagonist in the story. And then in the story where there's a black person who stars, there's always white people who had something to do with getting them to where they are and whatever. It can never be where it's just the focus of white America and how things are projected. So that's a whole area that I'll go into. But as I go into these things, I study them more myself.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on white allies? What does it mean to you, do you think, allyship is an important part of addressing racism and white privilege?
Sorry, the phone was ringing. Allies. Well, see, I think that white allies are important because it is true that we have to work together. We're all doing this together. And I missed the last part of what you said because, unfortunately, my phone was ringing. But what did you say?
I was just saying, what does it mean to you, and do you think allyship is an important part of addressing racism and white privilege?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, for example, Marian Anderson, she needed Roosevelt. I can't remember her name. Hello, help me here. Eleanor Roosevelt. Eleanor Roosevelt helped to get her to sing in a certain place. So their white allies play roles that are important. There's no question about it.
According to the Anti-Defamation League, there's been a sharp increase in hate crimes since 2016, and many point to President Trump as the cause, but others say that's too simplistic a view. What have we learned about racism and white privilege during the Trump presidency? Jim, what do you think?
Available because he's taking care of whatever the phone is.
Oh, he's on the phone. All right, so go ahead, Robin. Tell me what your thoughts are.
Okay. So my phone, presidency, I feel that America, it's always been there. This underlying current of racial hatred has been there. And when Obama became president, there was an undercurrent that was so powerful that it allowed for a Trump to come. Those people were indignant that a person from slavery could come up and become president. Obama is not ruling me. He's not going to be my president. And so Trump didn't just come out of the blue. It was always there, and all the political correctness, Trump did away with that. He allowed space for whites with hatred to come out. So it wasn't just about Trump, but Trump allowed it and, in fact, honored it. And people...
I think we're having some trouble with Robin's phone cutting in and out a little bit there. David, I want to talk about, you know, Robin's an artist and she was an art teacher. And we were talking a little bit about how art can inspire. And that's true across the board in many areas. And I think of this story often, and I'm pretty sure you're the one who told me about the school group that came through the center in an art exhibit, and the one kid who kept like with the questions, constant. And you're like, my goodness. And the teacher later telling you this child never does that.
Right.
Tell us that story. Yeah.
Every year in early in the year, this year it will be February, we have a winter art exhibit where the work is hung at a lower level, and we have most of the elementary age school children and some high school come through for a guided tour. And almost without exception, there's a child or two, or probably more than we know, that are so inspired by what they see on the wall and engaged in a way that, in this particular case, this was a student who was almost non-responsive in class, had no interest, rarely participated, extremely shy, and at this particular show, the art and the discussion of the art really opened the person up. And it just, you know, it's one more example of how important art and culture is to, you know, the development of the human person. You know, I tell another story of years ago, after the school had come through, a parent brought their daughter and son. They were American Indian and living in Wellfleet. And the gallery was closed. So the father said, "Oh, my daughter was here earlier today. She made us get in the car and drive here so she could show us what she had seen." So, of course, I opened the doors and turned the lights on and let them come through. And in the context of our conversation today, that was also an indication of, okay, here's a little piece of a diverse community that I didn't even know we have. And if I could, I want to go back and I just want to mention that I've had some of these uncomfortable feelings we're talking about during the past hour. And I was thinking during the break about a specific example that might be illuminating with Robin and Jim. I struggled with how to say things like, how do we increase the ethnic diversity of our audience without sounding like, because everything feels to me like it's us and them. It's like, how do these people become engaged with the organization? What do we need to do? And and the question to me sits uncomfortably, and I don't know why. So I think a lot of us share that, and a lot of us are afraid to say, you know what, Robin, I don't know how to ask you this, but, you know, how do we get more people from Zion, for example, to come just to look at the art gallery?
Right. And Robin, you know? We have just about a minute left. And Robin, it's just sincere questions, right? Being sincere. You can tell when somebody's sincere.
Yes, absolutely.
Robin, your phone is really bad. Robin's breaking up. But I think, David, that is a big part of it, right? That's true in anything. You can tell when somebody's... Yeah. I'm sorry, Robin's phone is so bad.
I'm sorry that Robin's phone is bad because she's so amazing and funny and hilarious. And I also feel like I'm the one who's not supposed to talk.
No, well, and you're right. Robin is and Jim are great. And for folks who want to hear more, there are definitely more conversations coming up. The next one is what, in February, David?
Yes. That you can go to our website, and we haven't posted the date yet, but it will be in February.
Yeah, and again, you can check out the ones that have the conversations that have already happened, and we'll have a link up on our website so folks can get to that easily at capeandislands.org. Look forward to the future conversations and educating us all. Robin Joyce Miller, artist, author, poet, educator, and resident artist at the Zion Union Heritage Museum. Jim Miller, poet, public speaker, and retired banker. David Keene, executive director of the Kituat Center for the Arts. Thank you all so much for being with us this morning. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Thanks.
Happy New Year.
I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.